Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. This is Johnny Tan, author of From My Mama's Kitchen, Food for the Soul, Recipes for Living. Welcome to my weekly talk radio show. My guest for this morning is David Berner. He is an award-winning author and journalist. David's latest book, Any Road Will Take You There, A Journey of Fathers and Sons, chronicles a heartwarming road trip discovery on generational bonds of fathers and sons. Good morning, David. Welcome to From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. How are you doing this morning?
Johnny, thank you very much. I'm doing wonderful. It's good to talk to you. I'm glad to be here.
Wonderful. It is a pleasure to have you on the air with me. Any Road Will Take You There speaks from the heart and to the heart. So I really enjoy that. It's very well written. Congratulations.
Thank you very much. It was really a labor of love that took several years and several drafts, you would imagine.
Mm-hmm.
As a lot of writers have told you, but it's been a good journey.
Fantastic. Let us start by getting to know you a little better. Please give us a quick walkthrough of your life from childhood to the present moment.
Wow. Okay. All 56 years, Johnny?
Yeah. We have roughly about 60 minutes, so you a minute for each year.
A minute a year. Okay. Yeah. Well, basically, I grew up in Western Pennsylvania. Came up in a very strong Irish Catholic my mother was English background, a very, Anglo-Saxon lifestyle, middle class, played outside, did all those wonderful things, had a wonderful childhood, good parents, very strong, sort of very, idyllic sort of American childhood. Mm-hmm. That's how I look at it now. You know, it's funny, you don't really see what you've been through until you get beyond it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It really was a very good childhood. I enjoyed myself and my parents were wonderful and supportive. I went to Clarion State University. At the time, it was called State University. Now it's just called Clarion University in the middle of Pennsylvania. Thought I wanted to be a teacher at the time and went into secondary ed, but ended up being a broadcaster, which is something I also loved, and ended up working in radio for many, many years, also writing freelance sort of work for many years. And a variety of things. I've written for art magazines. I've written about museums. I've written about the game of golf. I've written about travel. So it's been off and on. But I've also done a lot of general assignment reporting and audio documentaries. So my background has a lot to do with journalism. Moved to Chicago in the late 80s to work for CBS. And I've been in the Chicago area since then. I still work for CBS, but my main job these days is as an associate professor at Columbia College, Chicago. It gives me a lot of opportunity to write and to do a lot of journalistic work that I don't get a chance to do on a daily basis. So that's where I am right now.
Fantastic. When did you realize you have a talent for writing?
Well, I'm not even so sure that I have a talent for writing yet. I think because every writer, wonders it's late at night when they're lying in bed, whether they're faking it. I think mm-hmm. that's very true of even the greatest writers of all time, that we're fooling somebody. But mm-hmm. I have to tell you, I would say probably 2 or 3 years ago, I discovered I was moving at the time, and in a chest I had found an old book that I actually made when I was in, I'm guessing it was probably fourth or fifth grade, and it was called The Cyclops. And it was about this sea monster. Mm-hmm. And I had based it from my memory, when my memory was jarred a bit, I based it from the old Jacques Cousteau documentary mm-hmm. films that were a big deal back in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And I based this story on, the sea monster. And it was obviously a grade school kid's writing. And there was nothing fantastic about it. But it triggered in me that I probably was thinking about being a writer and writing work and writing books probably when I was in my elementary school days, but because no one in my circle had mm-hmm. that sort of sensibility, it was probably not nurtured. And I don't mean that in a disparaging way in any way. It just wasn't part of our life.
Mm-hmm.
And I probably had it back then. I probably had a sense of it, probably had a really strong feeling about storytelling mm-hmm. at that time, but it really didn't come to me until I got into college and began to work in the radio and tell stories on the radio and started to write a little bit. So college is where it started to blossom, I think. But I think there was a genesis of it. There was a little seed, probably when I was in elementary school.
That sounds fantastic. Were there authors that you followed over the years that inspired you in some ways?
Yeah, there are particular authors, and this is going to sound terribly cliche because many authors say the same thing, but you know, Hemingway, definitely. As I got older and became a little more in those teenage years and early 20s where you became a lot more cynical about things and questioned a lot of things, I started to look toward Jack Kerouac, which is obviously part of this book, and we'll get into that, I'm sure. But so there were some Kerouac influences. But I can say that I'm influenced by a lot of writers these days, people that I've never heard of, that I pick up a small book at a bookstore, I grab something on my Kindle that I can pick up, and I'm flabbergasted by how much great talent there is out there that's really not, in that large sort of way of saying this, discovered. There are people who are in the margins, and and they're very, very good writers. They're very good storytellers. So I get inspiration from a lot of different places.
Interesting. So it's basically the flavor that you were looking for at that point in life that sort of connects with whatever that's present out there that connects to you from a soul-to-soul perspective.
It's really about the writer connecting with the reader. And you know what? I don't think you're a writer unless you do connect with the reader. I mean, you know, if you're going to write in a room and do it as a journal and it's going to help you in some way, that's great. But if you really want to be a writer, you need to connect with the reader and anything that connects with me. And it is, you know, I find that's my favorite writer at the moment. You know, that's how it works.
Interesting. Does your writing offers you an escape in some ways to express yourself or just to entertain others? Because over the years, you have pretty much written so many different things and in so many different arenas.
Yeah, I have to say that writing for me, and I think I've learned this over time, writing for me is really something I do for me. It sounds terribly selfish. But I do write because I sort of feel like I have to. There are moments during the day where I say, yeah, I haven't written a little bit today. I need to do that. It's almost like working out. I know when I do workshops for people, I tell them, I said, look, you know, you can talk about writing all you want, but you need to get down and do the work. And, you know, put aside some time during the day and do that. And I feel that if I don't do that, I don't feel like my day is complete. So to answer your question, you know, it's really important for me to write, and that I feel like I'm writing for me. But I also, as I said before, it's so important when you're thinking, especially when you're going through a rewrite or a redraft, to remember the reader. I mean, they need to understand and connect and have it resonate for them. And that's just absolutely imperative.
Were there life experiences that influenced you most in your writing?
Well, there's no doubt that, you know, and because I'm a journalist, if I could back up for a second, because my training is very much a journalist, most of my work has been based on truth. You know, I had written a book called Accidental Lessons before this one, which is about a year that I taught in a troubled school district. And it, you know, it's a true story. It's a memoir. This book is a memoir. Any Road That Take You There is a memoir. I'm working on something now that's fiction, but I've also found that much of what's coming out of this book is based on things that really did happen to me. So to answer your question, it's a lot of what I write about is things that have happened to me or happened to someone I know, and they're very much relationship-oriented. The connection between people, the mother and the father and son, the girlfriend and boyfriend, the three teenage boys who did something goofy when they were 15 years old. I mean, it's all about, you know, it's all about that relationship, and it's about the human connection. And I found even when I do my documentary work in radio that the most important thing is that it resonates something about the human condition, something that we all share. And to me, that's most important. And whether it, through that it becomes a mystery or a suspense or literary fiction or whatever it is, that's all fine and good. But that relationship is what drives everything I write. Even when I write journalistically, I think in terms of you know, what's the thing that's human mm-hmm. about this? If that makes sense to you. So that,
oh yeah, yeah.
That's,
it
how,
sounds
that's
like,
how I feel. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it certainly does, because it looks like that you are on this conscious as well as subconscious journey about a search for meaning in life. And you found this real finite connection that it's about relationships. When you have relationships, everything else doesn't really matter, because the relationships is the one that generates the initial energy that creates everything else around it.
So that's absolutely true. And, you know, no story is a good story without a mm-hmm. human relationship. Mm-hmm. It just isn't. I mean, even if you're being very introspective, what are you being introspective about? Probably some relationship.
Right.
You know, and whether that, it could be a relationship with God, it could be a relationship with right. your dog. I mean, it could be anything.
Right.
That's just a key thing for me. Mm-hmm. I think about that all the time.
Interesting. So what inspired you to write Any Road Will Take You There?
Well, it began with some changes in my own life that were going on at the time. And I can't say that the book was directly generated out of this, but it certainly emerged from it. I went through a divorce. It was an amicable divorce. I'm still very good friends with my ex-wife. She's a best friend. But it was a difficult time. My kids were young. And that was troubling. I had gone through some work changes, and these are all things that, you know, everybody mm-hmm. experiences in some fashion,
right.
even if it's indirect. And those kinds of things made me start to reevaluate, which I think always does for human beings. I started mm-hmm. to reevaluate sort of where I was, where I wanted to go, and not just, and I don't mean this economically, I mean this sort of just life journey. And, you know, what I wanted to do and what really made me happy. And I found myself resorting back to some of the things that gave me energy when I was a young man. And some of those things were music. I played in a rock band for a lot of years. I played guitar mm-hmm. in coffee houses. You know, I did that. So music was a big thing. And certain books. And one of them was Jack Kerouac's On the Road. For me, that was one of the iconic books of my seminal years, if you want to call that, my coming of age. And, you know, I kept a copy in the back pocket of my jeans sometimes. And it was just one of those books that I felt very strongly about. And I reread it. And when I reread it, I said, boy, wouldn't it be kind of fun to just go out there and get, you know, drive around the country again. I didn't have the guts to do it when I was 18 to 20 years old. I was on a very strict path in my head about what I wanted to do with my life. And even though that was a wonderful dream, it was not something I was going to do back then. I felt like, well, you know, what the heck? And I really considered doing it. And long story short, I eventually got to that. And I decided, let's go out there. Let's do this. And I was going to do it alone. And then I was going to do it with a friend, which is very much like, you know, the book itself. The characters Sal Paradise and Dean Moriarty, who go out, and Jack Kerouac's real life is really about him and Neil Cassidy doing this. And I said to myself, you know, that would be great. As I got closer to the idea, I started to realize that I had two young sons and that, God, this would be such a terrible thing not to take them along on such an incredible trip. So it started to morph a little bit. And then during this period, just before this period, I should say, my father died. And I was helping my mother, and this is in the book, actually. I was helping my mother clean up some things in the house and move some things around. And we found an old picture at the bottom of a drawer that was a remarkable photograph. It was four generations of men. It was me as a young boy, my dad, my dad's father, and my great-grandfather, all standing together. And apparently it was Christmas time. And I said, well, why? I was astounded that this wasn't out somewhere, because it was such a remarkable photograph. And the story started to emerge about my father's difficulty with his father and the real sort of demons that happened there and how this picture was really very unusual, and that my father probably would not have, I would say, allowed, but certainly wouldn't have wanted this photograph to be out because of what his relationship was with his father. And I had known that he and his father had had some difficulty, but I really didn't know the extent of it. I never really knew his father, my grandfather. he just wasn't part of the family. And when he died, I mean, I didn't even go to the funeral. So that my mother felt like it was time to reveal all of this. She revealed all of it. And that really sparked me to say, wow, this trip is important. This trip with my sons is important. Because now I have to kind of figure out what kind of father I've been, what kind of father I am. Mm-hmm. And it became much more about fatherhood than about the trip itself. Although, as an older man reading Jack Kerouac, not as a young man, but as an older man, there are threads in that book that are very much connected to the father-son relationship. And they are strong threads that don't necessarily emerge when you're an 18-year-old boy reading it. You see other things. But as a middle-aged man, I saw the father-son connections throughout that book. And it just triggered in me that this is the book I should be holding in my hand as I get in the vehicle and travel off with my sons and try to figure out where I am as a man, where I am as a father, and what got me here, and what will get me to the next phase. And that's how it emerged and became what the book is.
That's a wonderful story. I mean, obviously, you having this humongous epiphany of life during that short period of time is sort of jammed up within you, where you are on the journey of self-discovery and at the same time realizing the bonding that you have with your dad and your sons in this case as well.
Right.
And being in the present moment, a lot of times we just really don't pay attention as much, I would think. But you were doing a lot of thinking at that time. Yeah.
Yeah, and I was doing a lot of thinking and a lot of things that I hadn't thought about in a long time. Yeah. And you know, for your listeners, certainly this was a self-indulgent kind of thing. I was very much thinking of myself at the time. But when I began to write the book, I started to think about the connections that we all have to fathers and sons, daughters and mothers, all those kinds of things. Yes, the book is about fathers and sons, but it's really about the parental relationship that is carried on almost, in my mind, genetically, that we don't even know about, that we don't even really can wrap our hearts or hands around. Yeah. And so that's what made it more than a sort of a, you know, self-indulgent journal of what I went through. It really has become a book that I think can resonate with anyone, whether you don't even have to have children, obviously, a son or a daughter of someone, right? So can everyone has that connection in some way, shape, or form, good, bad, or ugly. They're all imperfect ties, but they bind us anyway. So that was what was so important to me to reveal in the book itself.
Right. Well, your book certainly focuses on your relationships with your sons as well as your dad and so forth. But the one thing I got from the book is, of course, obviously, it's the idea of man coming to realization, or in this case, gender neutral here, that you're coming to realization, wait a minute now, I'm in the present moment, and before I could move forward, it doesn't matter where you are in your life, I have to reflect back upon the past.
Right, especially with the revelations that had been revealed to me, you know, through my mother's story. So with that, I had like new nuggets that I had never processed.
Mm-hmm.
I felt it was sort of time to do that. I'm not the kind of person who thinks about the past a lot. I mean, I certainly do, because we all get nostalgic to some extent. But this was more than that. This was not just nostalgic. This was something I had to bring out a shovel and dig to the hole and find out what was down there, because it helped me understand why I was the person I was. And that was really important to me at that moment.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you use the past as a guide to where you're heading for, you can certainly change the future.
Right, yeah. We've all, you know, how many times have we all said, you know, you can't change the past. You can only change what's in front of you. And sometimes you can't even change what's in front of you. You can only change the present. So the past shapes us. Sometimes in ways that we don't even realize. Mm-hmm. You know, in many ways, I never knew my grandfather, my dad's dad, But because of his actions, he has shaped me.
Right, right.
And I don't think I ever remember being in his presence, even though that photograph is there. I don't remember it.
Right, right.
So it's just interesting.
Right. Well, if you use the past as a guide just by itself, the future in some ways also never changed. But if you use it as a point of reference in some ways, then you can shape the future. Of course, the future is obviously initiated by you being in the present moment, making that conscious choice.
Yeah, that's very true. And I think that for me, that was helpful me to understand why I was the father I was and why I did the things I did, good, bad, and ugly, and why I did what I would do in the future. And I'm not saying it was the only thing that shaped me as a father, but it certainly had, it was the main root in that tree.
Right.
There's no question about that.
One of the things that you got in the book, which I thought was very interesting, because you're right, I guess in a parent-child relationship, or even in relationships in this matter, they see your good, bad, and ugly moments.
Well, do they ever, especially with the teenagers.
Right, right. And this is interesting. People don't realize that kids are always living in the present moment. We as adults don't.
Right. Right, yeah. Kids are very good at that. You wish you could carry that on for yourself, don't you?
Right.
Because it's such a good way to live if you can do it.
But they
definitely do live in the present moment, and they are making their determinations and they're sort of coming up with their own ideas at that very moment. So they're going to make judgments about their father in some way, shape, or form right then and there. So,
precisely.
So that was definitely part of the trip. There's no doubt about that.
Mm-hmm. Wonderful.
And the trip itself is, it was a 5,000-mile journey based a lot of on, not completely, but based somewhat on some of the roads that Kerouac traveled in the book On the Road. Mm-hmm. So there was that was sort of the thread. But the real thread was about the connections between fathers and sons. I mean, it's the road journey, the physical thread. But the emotional thread was something quite different.
Did you have anything in mind by choosing an RV as opposed to just a car and just getting then, let's hit the road, Jack, kind of thing?
Yeah, I know. Well, there's a part in the book that kind of explains a little bit what the process was of picking an RV. I really did not want to take an RV. It didn't seem very Jack Kerouacian, to get in an RV. But, we certainly weren't going to, like Kerouac did, hitchhike and jump trains. That wasn't going to happen. But I did want to do a car. I really wanted to do this a little more romanticized, I guess is the way you could put it.
Yeah.
And an RV did not seem terribly romantic. In fact, my son called it lame. But... But we came to that realization when we realized we were going to be doing a fair amount of traveling and driving, and that we could literally, in all intents and purposes, pull that thing off the side of the road and sleep in it if we needed to. So there was an element of that that made a little more logical sense.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, I guess, my romantic side pushed me into the journey. But my logical side said, we got to do this with a little bit of thought. And I don't regret taking the RV because there were some things about the RV that made it pleasant and revealed some things.
Mm-hmm.
But my romantic side says, geez, I wish we would have been in a 6'6 Mustang. But it's not going to happen. So that's what we decided to do through logic.
Yeah. Well, I picture it from a perspective of a moving living room, moving kitchen. And in a way, it was good because it allows the free flow of energy versus the confinement of, say, the size of a car, for that matter, because this gives you a different energy flow.
It definitely did, because there were times that I was able to, my buddy would drive and I would play the guitar and my son documented the whole thing on video. So he was, editing stuff and... it allowed people to get out of each other's hair for a couple of minutes and really, I think your comment is a very good one, to think of it as a moving living room or a moving kitchen. Because where do we have many of our conversations in a family, in a house, is around the kitchen, right?
Right.
So
right.
In many ways, you know, I think that may have, in some ways, subtly, sort of influenced the kind of energy that was in that thing.
Yeah, and I'm sure you guys have stopped by restaurants and places to eat and so forth, you know, the times to
sure.
connect and stretch out and everything else. But I think those heartfelt conversations in the RV itself, no matter how simple it is, whether it's a minute or two or 3 hour long conversation, but it meant so much because it's special, it's one-to-one, there's no distraction.
Right, right. And I think that happened between my buddy and I. Mm-hmm. Brad is the fellow that drove with me, one of my best friends.
Yeah.
And then I think it also happened between me and my sons. Now, a portion of the trip from Chicago to Denver, the very first leg of the trip was just myself and my two boys, who, by the way, were 12 and 14 at the time. So to give you a sense of the dynamic in the vehicle. So, that little leg there was just us. And the little leg at the end of the trip from Denver to Chicago, back to Chicago, was also just us. And
right.
I think that was interesting, too.
Yeah.
Because the energy when you first leave to go on a road trip, it's such an iconic American thing.
Right. Right.
That energy when you first pull out of the driveway is at just a wonderful place. You're at a moment where anything can happen, and you have the world in front of you. And I think it was great to experience that sort of feel with my sons. Although there were times along the way that my sons would say, "Are we going to keep driving?" they wanted to get out. And we did get out. I mean, obviously
right.
we did. But there were times I think they wanted to be out more often than we did. Because we Brad and I really enjoyed the sort of rubber on the pavement
feel for a long time. Well, did you start out having certain expectations you wanted to accomplish, or did you basically now planning is one thing, getting the RV, getting all packed up and hitting the road, and basically like a painter where you says, okay, hey, this is a blank canvas, anything happens.
Right. I think that I was probably about 75% anything will happen, happens. The only thing that we plan, and that was a little against my nature, I have to tell you. It was a little against my nature, so I had to fight that a little bit. But I'm glad that I did. The only thing that we did plan was obviously the RV. We had to rent the RV. We had made specific times for the RV, so that was planned. Whatever packing there was, although I told the boys one suitcase, that's it. A duffel bag would be best, or a backpack. And then, so that was the only thing. Plus, we did make got a rough idea of where we were going because we were basing it on the Kerouac novel. So there was a rough map. It wasn't a detailed map. There wasn't exact places to stop, although there were a couple in Denver because Denver is a very key part of the book on the road. So there were some Denver spots we wanted to hit, and also in San Francisco. But other than those little spots we wanted to hit, we never said how long we wanted to stay or anything like that. We just had a very rough idea.
Right.
I wanted it to be as blank of a slate as I could.
Right.
But in reality, we only had, so much time and kids had to be back to school, and there were some, real-life things in there that we had to consider.
Sure.
So I was trying really hard to keep it as blank as I could because I wanted it to be free-flowing as much as possible. Because I think that would have helped reveal some of the things I needed to reveal or things I needed to feel. And, many times the only time that we really know where we are and what we feel is when we are in a quiet place in our own head. And I felt like the best way to do that would be to leave that slate blank as much as possible.
Right. I'm picturing you guys basically in old wagon train, just the three and four of you guys. I mean, that's basically what it is. I mean, if you really want to enjoy a sense of appreciation, because that's how the old days people travel, and that's how they connect. What happens is that there's no other distraction. They have to be with themselves, and then they start learning about each other, learning about life, learning about, like you talk about, the human connection.
Right, and I think in those silent moments where you're trying to fill the space in your mind, those are where some of the really gems surface. And in our daily lives, we don't give ourselves time to do that. Mm-hmm. You know, you have to really, really try very hard to make time to do that. And I'm guilty of that too. I wish I could force myself sometimes to be a little more mindful, and I tried to do that a lot more often now than I ever have, but it's still not an easy process.
Mm-hmm.
So that part of it is hard. I had the opportunity 2 summers ago to be the writer in residence at the Jack Kerouac Project in Orlando, which is the house that Kerouac lived in at the time that he wrote the Dharma Bombs directly after On the Road. So he was becoming a famous author at that time, and lived down there in this apartment, but it was a back of a home. And they have turned it into a historical spot, and it's a chance where writers who apply and get selected can spend 2 or 3 months down there as a writer in residence and work on projects. And I was humbled to be able to get that, to be awarded that and go down there. And while I was there, I knew that I would have time to write, but I also wanted to have time to just be. Mm-hmm. And I really worked hard at that. And I have to tell you, the first few weeks were very difficult to just do nothing.
Yeah, yeah.
But once you get sort of past that and don't feel the guilt of doing nothing, because I do think that emerges, I think you get to places that you really, really are very happy that you got to. And that and you're reminded of how important those moments of just being are, you know, our daily lives don't allow that. And sometimes it's looked upon as being, neglectful or sloven or whatever. Mm-hmm. You do nothing. But I think they're important, you know.
Right.
And I learned that. I really did learn part of that while I was in Orlando.
Coming back to, you had mentioned this before about the DNA. Of course, I mean, as father and son, you connected from a DNA perspective, but somehow there are things that we learn in life that's really you don't learn because it's inherent within ourselves through the genes. What do you mean by that?
I'm certainly not a genealogist. I'm certainly not a biologist. I have no scientific background at all. But I truly believe that there are there's something in the linkage, whether it's a gene, a memory, whatever it is, there's something in the linkage between, in the blood relationships that we have that gets carried on that we don't even know. We don't even realize that these things are there. And I don't necessarily mean the color of our eyes or our hair color or our height or anything like that. I mean in terms of the experiences that we've lived. And the way, I'll give you an example through what was in the book. My great grandfather basically left the family and went to live with a woman down the street. I mean, that's basically what happened. And my father was a young man in high school when this happened. And it happened to be his best friend's mother.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, you can imagine what that must have been like. So for my father growing up, What happened to him in the most important years of his life as a teenage boy, his father disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
Now, without anyone ever saying anything, when my father became a father, the most important thing to him, and what he thought was the most important element to have as a father, was to just be there. Show up. Turn out at the Little League game. Be in the room when I was home. Not necessarily be the greatest interactor, not be the greatest conversationalist, but just to be physically there. And I never really understood that. You know, I never really thought about it until I started to get the idea that, okay, well, that's what he experienced. To him, all he wanted was his father to be there.
Right.
He didn't have that. So for him, it was important for him to change that.
Mm-hmm.
He probably never thought that consciously. He just did it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now, there's a flip side to that. If that had happened to maybe another person or maybe at a different time in my dad's life, maybe he would have fallen into the same pattern of his father, meaning, oh, my father wasn't here. I guess it doesn't matter if I'm here or not.
Right.
You know,
right.
It's very easy to go the other direction, too. So mm-hmm. I was lucky enough to have a dad who said to himself, subconsciously, my thought is, my belief is, like, I'm just going to be around.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
mm-hmm.
that carried to me. And all of this happened with me ever knowing about my grandfather's dalliance, my dad's issues with his dad. I never knew anything really hardcore about that. I didn't know
right.
all the details. But here I was, being the same kind of father my father was, in that I
yeah.
thought it was important to be there. And I still do that today. I find
mm-hmm.
myself just be available.
Yeah.
And that has influenced me as a father. Now, there are times that has gotten me in trouble because sometimes my kids don't want me to be there. You know? But I perceive that they need me to be there when they don't.
Right.
So I think sometimes that can be overboard. But I learned that through this, you know, sort of some osmosis in a way. Through
right.
the generations, through the DNA. I mean, that's where I think it came from because I didn't know the story. I didn't consciously say, I'm going to be there for my kids. I never thought anything like that. I just did it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So to me, I hope I'm answering your question, but I think that's
what I'm
trying to say in there is that there are these moments in time, these experiential things in our lives that influence us so greatly, we don't even know it's happening.
I agree. And your book does a very good job in terms of how you work the relationship that you have with your dad's flashbacks back and forth. And now I can see why you decide to write it from that perspective. Do you have a different sense of appreciation for your father in some ways?
You mean after the book?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well,
yeah.
Definitely.
Yeah. Absolutely so. I mean, I had my dad was interesting enough, a very good storyteller. He was not a reader, though. He would get two pages into a book and fall asleep. But he was a good storyteller. And part of that storytelling in all the forms that it could be was what made him who he was.
Mm-hmm.
And I really didn't see that until I got older. I also admire greatly the difficult life that he had as a young man through all of this with his dad, and that he was mm-hmm. able to be, you know, for all intents and purposes, a very good man and good father. I mean,
yeah.
to me, that's amazing
mm-hmm.
because it could have been very much justified if he had not been a very good man or good father. You could have very much justified by
right.
his early upbringing. You could
right.
have justified it. You may not have liked it, but you could have justified it. But he went
right.
the other direction.
Yeah.
And so I admire that greatly. That's a very difficult thing to go through as a young man, and he was able to, in a lot of ways, overcome it. But also, I think it scarred him
mm-hmm.
tremendously. And I think that those scars, you know, sort of revealed themselves and came to the surface throughout his life at different times.
Mm-hmm. Well, we are a product of our environment, and he made a conscious choice to be there as a father for you. That
yeah,
makes
he
a
did.
Big difference. Regardless of where we are from, that's the kind of thing that I was telling you about coming back to what we were talking about earlier. If you use the past as a guide, then the future never changes. But if you use it as a reference point, well, guess what? The future is what you make it out to be, and of course the actions have to be taken today, in the present moment.
Right, right. And it's very easy, I think, and I think it's almost human nature, just to sort of let yourself be who the world wants you to evolve into.
Yeah.
But it's something very different to say, okay, here's what where I've been or where my life has been or where my ancestors' life has been, and here's where I want to go, and to consciously keep that as sort of some kind of map in your hand. That's work. That is real work. And I'm not saying that I do that all the time very well. I'm certain that I don't. But I know that I do come back and revisit that thought.
Quite
often. Yeah.
Well, you're looking at it this way. If you make an honest effort, that's what counts.
Yeah. And I know my dad made an incredibly honest effort. Like I said, he could have gone a different direction, and he didn't. And I don't necessarily sit here and believe I'm the one who knows why he chose the more positive routes. I don't know, and I'm not so sure if he were sitting here now he could tell me. It just happened to be that way. I think that's where the therapist and psychoanalyst come in. I don't claim to be one of those. So.
Well, your writing about your relationship with your dad, I think it certainly adds a tremendous amount of flavor to the book, because that's where the bridging the generational gap comes in. And I think that's what it's all about. I think sometimes we forget that. We tend not to think about the past. And this is the funny thing about life. We tend to compartmentalize everything. So either we're in the present moment, we forget about the future or the past, or we think about the past and forget that, hey, I'm here. This is the most important thing in my life right now. And, of course, the journey allows you to do that, that you were able to fluidly going back and forth, the past, the present, and the future. I think that makes a big difference, and it makes it much more meaningful in so many ways. So coming back to the journey itself, were there times that you thought you were handling too much?
Well, the gas prices were outrageous. Spent a lot of money on gas, and that was not in the budget. So I can definitely tell you that. So, yeah, I mean, there were some things that let me put it this way. I think in a physical sense, taking on the RV was something none of us had ever driven an RV before. So in that sort of just practical thinking, that was a bit of a chore. Mm-hmm. And at one point, actually, we were doing really well with the RV. Until I was at one point coming from Denver to Chicago on the way home, and almost took out the side of a gas station tank because it's really difficult to maneuver in a gas station.
I'm
not exaggerating. I was a half an inch, but I had to keep backing the truck up little by little by little to get it around the corner so I wouldn't take out a gas tank. So in those practical physical things, there were things that I felt like, oh, wow, what did I take on here? And emotionally, too, I mean, I kept trying to tell myself, just let the trip be what it is. Don't try to make it into something. And that was something I had to keep repressing. I had to keep saying, okay, stop, trying to find meaning here when there's, just let it emerge. And I also think that would have made my son's crazy if I would have been, constantly considering those kinds of things. And so I tried to let things just be as much as I could. Did at times I think I took on too much? No, I mean, I never regretted it, even when you were out there and you were in the middle of unbelievable thunderstorms in New Mexico. Thunderstorms I have never seen before. They were scary. In an RV, it was a little scary. So there were those physical moments that were difficult. But I never regretted, taking it on physically or emotionally in any way.
Interesting. So what did you learn most from the journey?
Wow, that's I guess what I learned most is what's in the book, we are products of an environment, but we are also products of those who raise us, who bring us into the world, whether they're physically there or whether they're not, and that is an enormous part of our upbringing, and that those connections are what matter above all. Any kinds of relationships that we have in our life are what drive us and what energizes us through any part of our life. And I think that's what could resonate with the book for anybody who reads it, in mm-hmm. that, you know, you can see yourself, even though this is my story, you can see yourself and your relationships emerging out of many of the places in this book. I've had so many people mention to me at readings and things of that sort, interviews, who have said, you know, there's a part in there where this happened and that happened, and that reminded me of when this happened and that happened in my life and how what it meant to me. So, yeah, it's my story, and it's certainly things that I've learned. But I think the book can also be, and I don't mean it to be sort of some kind of revelation book or therapy book or anything like that. It's a story, and it's a story true and true, and that's it. But are there things that will emerge out of it that might set off a little spark in your head or make you rethink something? Certainly, and I hope so. And I think that's what I was able to learn, that that allowing the story to just happen, and my story being that trip, was a really important lesson to learn, in that manipulating what you hope will happen or what you think should happen or what you believe should be the end result of something is really not the best idea. If things are going to be what they're going to be, can you influence them? Yes, but they're going to be what they're going to be.
Right. What about your children? What about your sons? What have they learned from the trip?
They've learned that their dad's a pain in the neck sometimes, I think. But they already knew that. First of all, neither of them have read Jack Kerouac's On the Road. I've encouraged them to, and I think that there are parts of that book now that may not necessarily resonate the same way as they did when it was published. But I think that, I still tell them that it's the kind of book that is energizing and can be freeing, and I encourage them. So I hope that someday that they will take a look at that. But coming out of this journey, I think that they've learned that, you know, that their dad is far more than just their dad. That I'm a man. I have done good things and had mistakes and can stumble, and that I am not invincible. And I think those are good things for any child to learn at some point in their life, because as very young children, we all think our parents are going to be there forever, or at least we hope in good family relationships that, you know, they're always going to be there, they're always going to be supportive, they're always going to be around, they're going to protect us. And the reality is, you know, we won't be. Whether we die or whether we just become self-indulgent. I think they learned that their father is, put it very simply, his father is more than just a father. And that there's parts of me that they had never really learned about before, and they still not really totally understand. And that's okay.
Well, they have to go through the process of, well, I know it all, I may not know it all, in the early 20s to the 30s or so, and then finally they get to a point in their life that they say, I don't know squat. And that's when they have the sense of appreciation of who you are beyond that.
And I think I went through that same process with my dad. My father never said he loved me until I was in my late 30s. And it was not because he didn't love me, and I knew that. I mean, I knew that he loved me. There's no question about it. But it was not part of his makeup. It was not part of what he went through. His father probably never said it to him. So it was part of his experiential life. But my boys, on the other hand, I mean, I've said every day I said to them I love them. So it's a different experience, and I hope that that experience carries on through them, that they learn that not only that little gesture of love, but what it really means and where it comes from, you know.
Yeah.
But it isn't just, you know, a couple of words.
Right. Well, it's the action that counts, and you know that your dad loved you all this while because the actions that he put forth, being there with you. I recall in reading your book in terms of reflecting my relationship with my father, and I mentioned to you before the show starts where he passed on when I was 19, when I came to the United States. The one thing that hit me the most when I found out about his death was the fact that the last thing I did with him was basically shook his hand at the airport. Because I came from the culture in Malaysia to whereby that's what we do. Good luck, son. Thank you, Dad, kind of thing.
Right.
Over here in the United States, we move into the hugging thing.
Right.
And there's so much warmth to it. I can't say I regret it. I mean, yes and no, because that's the standards at that time in Malaysia, what we're doing. But, yeah, I would wish to have hugged him because I know it makes a big difference from that perspective. But having said that, I knew, did he love me less or did I love him less? I don't think so. I think he realized we're there for each other.
Well, I think in a lot of ways, you know, your handshake was also your hug for that time and place.
Oh, yeah,
I mean, it was the equivalent of that in that culture, in that time and place. And I think that that was a lot of what I went through when I was a younger man, when my dad, you know, I never consciously said, gee, I wish he'd tell me he loved me. I never thought that. But when he, because I knew it. But when he said it, it was like, oh, wow.
Yeah.
He just said it, you know. Yeah, which kind of threw me off because I'd never heard it before. But not that I was longing to hear it because I knew it.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Fantastic. What would you like for your readers to gain from reading Any Road Will Take You There?
Well, Any Road Will Take You There really is just, you know, it's a journey of follows the suns. That's what the subtitle is, and it really is. And I think that says in a lot of ways the physical journey, which is part of the fun part of the book, and there's humor in it, and there's those kinds of things. But what I really like them to take about that journey of fathers and sons is there is no end to it.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a destination because it travels through us, from us, to the next generation.
Yeah.
And it will continue to do that, and it will always do that in some shape or form. And that the way that we react and the way that we live our lives with our sons and daughters is going to somehow show up three generations down the road. And I don't say that in a way to be judgmental. I don't say that in a way to say, hey, you better watch your step and do the right things.
Right.
What I'm saying is that just be aware of it. Just be aware that those things are there and they are always going to be there and they are part of that journey. And to savor it, you know, savor it as you're figuring this out. You know, don't look at it as good, bad, or ugly. Just savor the moment, because even the bad moments are ones that shape us and sometimes can turn out to be good things.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of a long answer, but I think in terms of what the relationship you have, how you got there, and where it's going to go many, many generations down the line.
Wonderful. It's the ripple effect, basically.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Wonderful. Where can someone go to buy your book, get more information about you, and keep up with your latest happenings?
Well, I appreciate that. First of all, Amazon is probably the best place to find the book. There's a Kindle version, paperback version. That's probably the easiest way to get it. Although if you're a real bookstore person and that's how you do your stuff, if they don't have it, they can order it for you. Any Road Will Take You There. My name, David W. Berner. There's another David Berner out there, by the way, but it's not a W, so that's why the W is in there.
Okay.
So ask for David W. Berner if you're looking for just the author and you don't remember the name of the book. So those are the best places. If you want to kind of see where I am or where I'm going to be or what I'm going to do next or what I may be working on or whatever, website's very simple. It's davidwberner.com. And I'm all over the Internet. So if you just Google my name, you'll find me. I'm the David Berner who has no hair. So if you image and you see a guy with a lot of hair, that's not the David Berner. That's
see, now it becomes a signature deal.
Yeah, maybe so. Yeah.
Wonderful. By the way, we're coming close to the end of the hour. Since our show is about people, family, and living life, what would you like to share as a recipe for living with our listeners this morning?
Well, I think that it's important, and I learned this later in life, to be mindful of the moment. And I think sometimes that may sound terribly cliche, but I think it's so absolutely true. Be mindful of the moment you're having with the people you love. You know, be in the present as much as you possibly can. I know that's hard in our society, but it really is important to be in the present. You know, I had a very dear friend to me say one time that when I'm with a person, I try to be 100% with that person, meaning I'm not thinking about the guy down the street. I'm not thinking about the boss I need to talk to. I'm not looking at my phone. You know, I'm 100% with the person I'm with. And I don't do that very well. I have to try very hard to be that way. And I'm trying harder all the time. So to be very mindful of the moment you have with the people you love in the present time is extremely important, and it will bring you benefits you don't even know about.
That's fantastic. That's fabulous. You got a couple of minutes here to talk about how has writing Any Robot Take Your Day impacted you personally?
Well, that's a tough one because I still think I'm sort of on that journey. but I have to say that, you know, the book originally started out as a series of essays about fatherhood. True stories, essays.
Yeah.
And an agent helped me shape it into a bigger, stronger book with this thread and this story. Because one of the stories in the original book of essays, manuscript of essays, was about this trip, but we just expanded the trip and made it, you know, the whole thread. So I think I've learned about writing. I think I've learned about finding threads in stories that resonate. But I also think about, for myself, what I've learned is what I just mentioned a moment ago, is how important it is to be in the moment and how important it is to be mindful in the moment. And I, you know, I use that word mindful a fair amount. My kids tell me I use it way too much. But it is the word that really says it. And I think that's what I've learned. That's what I hope to keep working on. And carry with me, most importantly.
Fantastic. Well, David, thank you for the great recipe for living and for spending this hour with me on From My Mama's Kitchen Talk Radio. To all our listeners, thank you for being with us. Please join me next Tuesday morning. My guest will be Paul Wedding. He is a best-selling author, a nationally recognized speaker, and a personal development counselor. Paul will be revealing his intimate, life-changing encounter with God that saved him from the brink of self-destruction. For additional information about this show and future shows, please go to FromMyMamasKitchen.com. Thank you for listening and have a blessed week. David, thank you again and have a blessed day.
Thank you, Johnny. It's been wonderful. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Thanks to your listeners.
Thank you. Bye-bye.